Welcome to another episode of 40 Minutes in the Old Testament. 40 Minutes in the Old Testament is a 1517 Podcast Network podcast. You can go to 1517.org/podcast and check out all the other podcasts that are living over there. And while you're over there, hit that events page. Chad, we got city events coming up quick here, man. We're going to be hanging out soon down in Houston.
Yeah, like, I don't know, 2-3 weeks? Where are we at?
Yeah, the 22nd of February, we will be down there. Chad will be there. I'll be there hanging out with Loso and Scott Keith and Gretchen Ronovic and Matt Popovitz. It's going to be a good time. We're going to be talking about what happens when people encounter Jesus. So, man, if you're in Texas, really just anywhere in Texas, I know it's a big state, but I mean, if you're really anywhere, and especially in the southern part of Texas, like the southern half of Texas, you got to come over to Houston and hang out with Chad and I. Got to do it. So you can go over there, go to the event page, click on it. All the information's there. All you do is sign up and then show up. That's it. But maybe you don't live there and you're somewhere in the Las Vegas area. We'll be there March 21st. Registration for that is also open. And we'd love to see you there at that event. Also, Europe, we're going to be there. The Great Freedom Conference in Germany. I'll put a link in the show notes. You can go over and sign up. That thing is filling up, actually. If you're in Germany, you want to get in on that because there's actually not that many tickets left to that event, actually. So we're rooting for that sellout. Also, Stockholm, Sweden. Registration is now open for that as well. I will put a link in the show notes. So just scroll down if you're listening on the website. If you're listening to the podcast on the app, just click over and you'll see the list of things. You can find the link. So if you're in Germany or Sweden, we would love to hang out with you. We're going to be there in Germany the first week in May and in Sweden the second week in May. And that's going to be quite exciting. Looking forward to it. All right, Chad, where are we at in this book of Judges?
We have a little poetry today. We're in Judges chapter 5, which is the poetic parallel to the prose account that we just covered this past time in Judges chapter 4. So we heard about Deborah and Barak and that very feisty and dangerous lady named Jael. So we heard all about the story last time. And now we're going to hear the musical that's based upon that particular story. So it's a really interesting chapter for a number of reasons. Probably the most, at least for me, from my perspective, one of the most fascinating aspects of the story is just how closely, just thematically, it parallels the Song of the Sea that the Israelites sang after they crossed the Red Sea and the Egyptians were destroyed. So it's one of these, I pointed out a couple of times last episode how there were parallels between the Exodus account and what happened with the defeat of Sisera in chapter 4. So we'll hit on a couple of those as well when we get into chapter 5. If we finish that, which I think we will, we'll jump into a long section of Judges. The next major section is all about Gideon and his call, his exploits, and as we'll see at the end, his gradual sinking into idolatry, which is the kind of the bleak way that his story ends. And then following up with that, his son Abimelech. So once we get to Judges 6, we got a big section that we'll address with regard to Gideon. But anyway, before we get there, we'll cover Judges chapter 5. I mentioned last time this is this really doesn't affect us as English readers, but if anybody listening out there knows Hebrew and has read a little bit of Judges chapter 5 in the Hebrew, you know that it's pretty rough. Just because this is, it's kind of like, you know, if you take a class, you're in high school or you're in college and you read Shakespeare or you read something in Old English, well, it's a little bit tough, right? I mean, you can kind of, you know, you get the gist of the story, but there's a lot of words you got to look up. There's a lot of kind of arcane language. Some words you know, some words you don't know. Well, it's kind of like that with Judges chapter 5. This is a very, very old style of Hebrew. I read recently that like 70% of the poem has translation challenges, we'll call them, because there's words that we call a hapax, which means they only occur once in the whole Bible. And when you only have a word occurring once, a Hebrew or a Greek word only occurring once, it's a challenge sometimes to make sure that you're understanding it and translating it correctly. So there's some of that in there. So the only way that you'll probably notice this if you're just reading in English is if you happen to be in a Bible study. And, you know, somebody's reading out of the NIV, another person's reading out of the ESV, somebody else is reading out of the New American Standard. And you'll come across some verses where these translations just don't line up all that well. Well, it's really not the translator's fault. Probably doing the best they can, because there's just some challenging Hebrew behind this particular poem. So with that is kind of a preface. We'll jump right in. So this way it begins. It says that Deborah and Barak, the son of Abinoam, sang on that day, saying. So we know this is a song because it calls it that right away. This isn't just poetry, but this was actually meant to be sung, as were many sections of the Old Testament. And even though it says this is the song of Deborah and Barak, it's kind of a nod to Barak, but he really, as we read in the last chapter, he doesn't really get much credit, because he acted, you know, somewhat hesitantly and cowardly. In fact, Deborah even tells him the honor is not going to go to you, but the honor is going to go to a woman. And that was ambiguous at first, but when we get to the end of the story, we realize, this woman was actually Jael. She's the one, the tent peg lady. So this is really, this is traditionally called Deborah's song, and rightly so. In fact, in verse 7, she even speaks in the first person. So I, Deborah, arose a mother in Israel. And, you know, this kind of fits with her being the author of this song, fits with her vocation. As we learn in chapter 4, she is a prophetess, and prophets very often, you read Isaiah, you read Jeremiah, you read the minor prophets, almost everything is recorded for us in poetry. So it would kind of make sense that this early prophetess would actually turn her understanding of what happened from a prophetic perspective into not just poetry, but into actually poetry which was sung.
Yeah, it's interesting that, you know, you don't have like a ton of examples of, you know, prophetesses. We don't know how common this was, but we have a couple of examples, and where we do have examples, it seems that busting out some songs is something that they will do, right?
Yeah.
This seems like a very common thing. Like this is one of the things they do. They will like prophetically place like something like this. So this is a victory of the Lord, and they will like they will place this into song so that the people have it forever.
Right, right. You know, and not just prophetesses, but you know, you think of Hannah, beginning of 1 Samuel. Of course, she sings that song of Thanksgiving, more than just Thanksgiving. I mean, it's a very theological song, giving thanks to God for the birth of her child, which is Samuel. And then you fast forward to Mary, who's kind of the New Testament counterpart to Hannah. And of course she sings her song, the Magnificat. So yeah, I mean, it is seemingly expected in many of these cases for women who are put forward either as leaders or as examples to take what they experienced, their hopes, their fears, their thanksgiving, and to translate that into song. And the beautiful thing about that is, as you alluded, that this becomes not just something you read, but it becomes part of kind of the culture and the heritage of the people, right? I mean, there's a lot of things that we don't remember from history unless they're put into a song. You know, you have a lot of historical events that have been translated into something which people sing, or at least into poetry, like the Midnight Ride of Paul Revere, and so you remember it because it becomes something you memorize or you recite or you sing.
Yeah, this is sort of a lost thing now because we have so many ways of documenting things and all that kind of stuff. But literally, this was the surest way to keep something alive for a long time was to put in a song. And this went on for a very, very long time. If you've ever seen the movie Braveheart, that movie is based on a character that exists in song. This is how this works. Like, that's it. Like, was he real? They don't even know. They're like, I think so. Maybe. Probably. Like, there seems to be. There was other people that were real, like Robert the Bruce and that kind of stuff. generations later, they made this movie, and like they wanted to enshrine this thing in song. And so all the Scottish people know this song about this guy, and they have his story in a song. And that's just one example, but that was the case for all kinds of things that like that people take and they say these are we're gonna put our history into melody and into music, and then we're gonna pass it down for generations. And that stuff was an effective way to do it for a very, very long time.
Braveheart, by the way, probably the best movie ever made.
Dude,
in my not so humble opinion.
Just the other day, my wife says to me as I say something about Braveheart, she's like, yeah, you know, I've never seen Braveheart. Felt like I had made a huge mistake. Like I've done something wrong, not by marrying her, but just that we've been married for quite a while now. How is
this even possible?
How is this possible? Like we're coming up like 13 years of marriage, and that made me think, has it been 13 years since I've seen Braveheart? Like I am due.
Yeah. You need to watch that at least once every couple of years.
Yeah. I'm failing over here.
I know, man. Yeah, you get your act together.
I know. It's not like I know the song, so I can't remind myself of his great deeds that way. I don't know it.
You just got to watch the movie. Okay, well, let's get into it. Starts out with a blessing of the Lord, which is basically anytime you bless the Lord, that's a Hebrew way of giving thanks to God and implicitly acknowledging him as the source of blessings for you. So that the leaders led in Israel, that the people volunteered, bless the Lord. It's like we're going to hear one of the major themes of this song, that when it became necessary for the Israelites to jump into the battle, that there were people who volunteered. They willingly gave themselves to battle. Now, a corresponding flip side to that is that there were some who did not. And we're going to hear about those when we get to verses 14, 15, and 16, that not all of the tribes actually leapt to their feet and ran to the battle for Israel. So there's this kind of minor note of dissonance that's between the various tribes. So some volunteered, some did not. And then verse 3, I love this. Anytime that the Psalms do this, or any song actually does this, I think it's sort of humorous. Says, hear, O kings, give ear, O rulers. I to the Lord, I will sing. So the song is addressing kings, rulers, presumably of the non-Israelite people groups. So, and you hear this a lot in the Psalms, right? These addressed to the nations, to the Goyim, to the Gentiles. Well, this is kind of a common poetic approach where you will address your enemies in a song that you're singing. And it's sort of a taunting sort of way. Like, give ear, O kings, you're going to get destroyed. Give ear, O rulers, you're going to be trampled by the host of Israel. That kind of language. And I was thinking, and as I was looking over this morning, I was thinking that, you know, we still do this. One of my favorite hymns is on baptism. It's God's Own Child, I Gladly Say It. It's written by a 18th century poet named Erdmann Neumeister. But anyway, it's all about baptism. Beautiful tune, beautiful text. God's Own Child, I Gladly Say It. But listen to just the beginning of three of the stanzas. So stanza 2 starts out this way: sin, disturb my soul no longer. I am baptized into Christ. And then verse 3. Satan, hear this proclamation. I am baptized into Christ. And then finally, the fourth, death, you cannot end my gladness. I am baptized into Christ. So three of those stanzas are addressing enemies, addressing death, addressing sin, addressing Satan.
Well, these and are the, it's these in are
sort
the
of
three,
a taunting sort of way.
Well, scripturally, too, these are the three great enemies, right?
Yeah.
Sin, death, and the devil.
Yeah. Yeah, they're the three great enemies. And, people like Sisera that we heard about in this last chapter, the enemy of Israel, or really any of the enemies of Israel, they are nothing but icons of those three great enemies. In fact, it's quite fitting, I think, that this particular enemy is destroyed. Sisera is destroyed. How? Well, not by getting shot through with an arrow or stabbed with a spear or anything like that. Some you know, terrible leg wound. He bleeds out. No, he's actually killed with something being driven through his head, which, as I think I mentioned this last time, fits with that pretty broad biblical theme of the enemies of God either having their heads crushed or cut off or something like that, all of which goes back to Genesis 3:15, where the arch enemy, Satan, will have his head crushed. So those who are doing his bidding, whether they're a Sisera or whether they're a Pharaoh or whether they're Goliath or whoever they might be, they become emblems of the enemy, of the true enemy, sin, death, and the devil, because they're doing his bidding and attacking the people of God. So anyway, it starts out this way. Then goes on, I will sing praise to the Lord, the God of Israel. And then it has this real graphic depiction of God marching through the land to come to the aid of his people. It says, Lord, when you went out from Seir, which is south, the south country, when you marched from the field of Edom, Edom being again south, what happened? The earth quaked, the heavens dripped, even the clouds dripped water, the mountains quaked at the presence of the Lord, this Sinai at the presence of the Lord, the God of Israel. So you have this imagery, or he pictures like when God shows up to rescue him, it's like all of creation goes crazy. So you have thundering, you have lightning, you have hail, you have torrential rain, you have mountains that are trembling. All it's like creation is just, the way I pictured it is like there's this giant walking through the land and everything is quivering, everything is shaking, even the heavens themselves. So that's kind of this image of God heading from the south, marching through the land. And as he goes along, the heavens reacting and the earth is reacting, and he's coming because he's coming to rescue his people.
Yeah, and you see this play out, and obviously all rescuing of Israel and all this stuff is all, you know, it all finds its consumption in the work of Christ, and you see in the work of Christ and the actual work of dying and rising, you do see this as a dramatic effect on the earth. You have darkness and earthquakes and, you know, all this sort of stuff going on at the death. I mean, the resurrection is similar, where you have the earth itself. This is why, I mean, you have even the Bible is interesting how it talks about creation almost as a person, right? That it like groans, yes, and it cries out, it responds in certain ways. Yeah, it's interesting. So in this song, and in lots of songs, you have the earth, God using creation to bring about his will and his judgment or his rescue, but also it sort of, God interacts with creation in a far more personal way than you would think he might.
Yeah. And there's a couple of messages there that are embedded in that. And one is that God isn't just like a lot of the gods of the ancient Near East. He wasn't geographically restricted. I mean, most gods, they kind of respected the boundaries, you know, so it was the god of Edom or the god of Midian or the god of Egypt, whatever. They pretty much stayed where their people were at, not God. And he's like coming from Seir. He's marching through Edom because he's, of course, in the Israelite mind, he's the only god. So he owns all the earth. So all creation reacts to him, not just that particular part of the world, namely Israel. And then secondly, that, you know, all creation is involved in the saving work of Christ. And this goes back to what you were talking about earlier, that all creation is redeemed by Christ. That's why there's going to be a new creation, new heavens and a new earth. And of course, Christ dies to redeem us, but the implication of that is much broader. Just as sin infected the world and led to the world being messed up in so many different ways, creation being messed up in so many different ways, so through the redeeming work of Christ, creation will be perfected, will be recreated, so that just as it went south, so also God is going to raise it back up. Okay, so moving on, verse 6. Takes us back actually to a guy that we heard about in one verse a couple chapters back, Shamgar. In the days of Shamgar, the son of Anat, in the days of Jael, The highways were deserted, and travelers went by roundabout ways. The peasantry, or the villagers, ceased. They ceased in Israel. Until I, Deborah, arose. Until I arose, a mother in Israel. So I think what is being depicted here is basically that things were bad. So in the days of Shamgar, who was probably almost a contemporary of these folks, and Jael, the highways were deserted because things were so bad for the Israelites. It was a dangerous place. They weren't safe. They were being attacked. They were being ruled over by foreign powers. And so the villagers ceased. I mean, they were in a position of weakness. They didn't have fortified cities. They just tried to fortify themselves as best they could, but they were living in villages. Until, it says, I, Deborah, arose. I arose, a mother in Israel. We'll get to more of that in just a minute, because she's inserting herself here, because when she comes, things begin to change. She is the one that God raises up as this prophetess in order to give hope and counsel and guidance to Israel, and really to be for them this living image that God is present with them. Of course, that's why when Barak is told to go off to war, he says, nope, not unless you go with me. So she herself becomes the one who is representative of God's word and his will for Israel. She goes on, new gods were chosen, then war was in the gates. So basically, Israel created this situation. As we've heard already, and as we'll hear multiple times through the book of Judges, they forsake the way of the Lord, they go after other gods. And when these new gods were chosen, well then, yeah, there was war, because God handed them over to their enemies. But things were so bad, it says, that not a spear or shield was seen in Israel among 40,000 in Israel. So they didn't even have weapons. That's how bad things had become. Okay, so we have this kind of bleak picture, and we have hope arising with the coming of Deborah. So what's going to happen? She says, my heart goes out to the commanders of Israel, the volunteers among the people. Bless the Lord. So we have, again, this same thing we heard at the beginning of it, that there's these people that come out to fight for Israel. And then the next two verses are a little bit difficult. It talks about the people who ride on white donkeys, who sit on rich carpets, who travel the road, sing, she says. Presumably, these would be like traders, those who had the money, had the kind of transportation, these tawny or white donkeys to ride on. Anyway, she calls upon them to sing. And then verse 11, at the sound of those who divide flocks among the watering places, there they shall recount the righteous deeds of the Lord, the righteous deeds for his villagers in Israel. Then the people of the Lord went down to the gates. Verse 11 is probably the hardest verse in this particular poem, because there's so much that's just a little bit ambiguous. I think what it's talking about is that when the people are gathered at the watering places, that's kind of where they talked, right? That's where everybody was at. That was the gathering place. So they talk about what God is doing and what he will do for the Israelites. Okay, so that takes us through verse 11. We'll pick up at 12. It's a transition to the next part of the song. Awake, awake, Deborah. Awake, awake, sing a song. Arise, Barak, and take away your captives, O son of Abinoam. So here we have this call to awake, to arouse, to get to action, in other words, Deborah and Barak. It says, the survivors came down to the nobles. The people of the Lord came down to me as warriors. So this is the poetic description of her gathering the people for war. They're gathering around Barak, who is chosen as the one who's going to lead them. And then we have in verses 14, 15, 16, 17, and 18. So 14 through 18, we have a description of, I think there's 9 or 10 tribes that are mentioned here, some by name, some by an individual's name that's connected with the tribe. Now, most of these tribes are described as actually coming to the aid of Deborah and Barak. So we have Ephraim mentioned. We have Benjamin mentioned. We have verse 14 mentions Machir, which is probably the tribe of Manasseh, because that's the tribe that Machir was from, as we hear in Genesis chapter 50. So Ephraim, Benjamin, Manasseh, Zebulun is also mentioned, Issachar. So all of these tribes, it says they came to Barak, the leader, into the valley. They rushed at his heels. So that's all good. She's praising these tribes for coming to the aid of their brothers in this time of attacks, in a time of attacking God's enemies. But then she shifts and she talks about the tribes who weren't involved. One of those was Reuben. So why did you sit among the sheepfolds, among the divisions of Reuben? And she describes like great searchings of heart among the tribes of Reuben. It's like, of course, Reuben, if you remember from Joshua and even from Deuteronomy, the Reubenites and the Gadites and half the tribe of Manasseh, they didn't want to cross over. They wanted land on the western side. So probably they're like, things are good with us over here. We're gonna stick with our sheepfolds, and we don't want to get involved in your conflicts across the Jordan River. So Reuben does not come out looking good, but it's the same with Gad. And then Dan, who's located close to the shore, stays in his ships. Asher also stays there by the seashore. So there's this criticism built into the song of these tribes who didn't do their duty. They didn't rise when they were called to warfare. And this is pretty characteristic of the days before the monarchy, before there was a king. You had this kind of loose confederation of the tribes, and probably even some of the judges only operated with certain of the tribes in certain areas. You didn't have any kind of cohesion. In fact, you still had that division part of the time during the reign of David. At first, it was just like his tribe, the tribe of Judah and then Benjamin, they were on the side of David. It wasn't until later he was actually able to consolidate all of Israel. See, when in these early days of Israel, you can't picture them as being like united as in the days of the monarchy. There was it's just a lot of kind of, we're doing our thing, you do your thing, and maybe we'll come to help you, maybe we won't. And that's what this is reflecting. This frustration with some of these tribes for sitting on their hands during this time of conflict instead of actually getting up and coming to the aid of coming to the aid of Deborah and Barak.
But it kind of makes sense of the request of the people to have a king. You might wonder, like, why did Israel want a king? Why did they want to be like other nations? Like, they have God. Like, this seems, and of course, God does say, like, hey, don't worry, they're not rejecting you, they're rejecting me, that kind of thing. But practically, you can understand it where they're like, we are all just kind of calling our own shots here. It'd probably be, we've been in and out of captivity. We got people at war with us all the time, and sometimes people come to help, sometimes they don't. It'd be better if we just had like one guy calling all the shots for this whole thing. We would be more powerful that way. I mean, the United States is probably a decent example. Imagine if we didn't have a president. We just had all the governors deciding, well, maybe we'll come over there and help you. I mean, it'd be crazy.
Yeah, it would be. Yeah, and you can see kind of the twofold, one positive and one negative of having a king. Because, I mean, when you have, well, of course, Saul was not a good king. But when you have David and Solomon, yeah, you do have a consolidation of the tribes, right? Mm-hmm. He does unite them, and Solomon does too. I mean, look at this spectacular wealth and power and the building of the temple, the expansion of the geographical boundaries of Israel. There were a lot of things, good things, that happened for the Israelites when they had the second and then the third king, when they had David and his son Solomon. So there was certainly a positive side to that. Of course, as with any positive side, you have a negative side too, because Solomon ends up marrying a lot of foreign wives, consolidating his power by marrying the daughters of foreign kings. Well, they bring their religion and their worship of foreign gods into Jerusalem. And to build the temple, Solomon and his own palace, he levies these big taxes upon the people. And so by the time his son Rehoboam becomes king, people are like, yeah, we want you to lower our taxes. We're sick of you impoverishing us in order to fund your building projects. And of course, when Rehoboam doesn't do that, you have the split of the kingdom, and you're right back where you started. We have now a northern kingdom and a southern kingdom. So yeah, it's like one of those, you can't win, you can't lose when you have a king in Israel, because you're going to have some good and you're also going to have some bad.
Yeah. Yeah. But the practicality of asking for it makes sense in light of their history.
Oh yeah. Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. A lot of like what's happening right here. Okay. So it says verse 19, the kings came and fought. They fought, then fought the kings of Canaan at Taanach near the waters of Megiddo. This is a description of where the battle happened that we read about in the previous chapter. Now listen to this. This is crazy. The stars fought from heaven. This is verse 20. From their courses, they fought against Sisera. So we have stars fighting, but we're not done. It says the torrent of Kishon swept them away. The ancient torrent, the torrent Kishon. So you've got heaven and earth fighting against the enemies of Israel too. So you have this, and we have this image elsewhere too in the Psalms of heaven fighting against the enemies of Israel. Here it's the stars. We don't know if this is like poetic hyperbole or if actually something happened. We've heard about hailstones falling from heaven against the enemies of Israel. So whatever stars fighting from heaven means, this is heaven fighting against the enemies of Israel. And not only that, but Kishon, which was ordinarily a pretty mild stream, all of a sudden it becomes a torrent, and it's fighting against the enemies of Israel as well. So it's like all of creation is conspiring against Sisera and against his armies, just like, and this is one of those parallels with Exodus 15, just like at the Red Sea. You have the waters that are fighting against the Egyptians. So here you have the waters from Kishon that are fighting against the Canaanites.
I choose to believe that asteroids were shooting out of the sky and blowing up the chariots.
That's totally what happened. Yeah.
The stars are fighting on our side. The asteroids are making direct hits on these iron chariots.
When we make the movie, that's exactly what's going to happen. Yeah.
That's it.
Yeah. I might even put a Sharknado in there too.
Sharknadoes. Maybe. out of that torrent stream. There's sharks in there. And like...
Right. Yeah. Ham it up a little bit. Okay. So, it goes on to talk about the horse's hooves beating, the dashing of the horse's hooves. And then verse 23 wraps up this section. It says, curse Meroz, said the angel of the Lord. Utterly curse its inhabitants, because they did not come to the help of the Lord, to the help of the Lord against the warriors. Now, we really don't know where Meroz is at. This is the only time it's ever mentioned in the Old Testament. I'm assuming that Meroz was kind of understood to be symbolic of all those places that didn't come to the help of Israel. So this curse is pronounced upon them. Okay, so that concludes the first 23 verses. Now, the two last sections are pretty fascinating. The first one's about Jael. They're both about women. The first is about Jael, poetic rendering of her taking out Sisera. And then verse 28 through 31 is very, very unique. It tells the story from the perspective of the mother of Sisera. She waits for her son to return from war. So here's the way the Jael one goes. Most blessed of women is Jael, the wife of Heber the Kenite. Most blessed is she of women in the tent. He asked for water, and she gave him milk. In a magnificent bowl, she brought him curds. So you remember that part of the story, right? He goes into the tent. He asks for something to drink. She brings him milk.
Apparently, she brought him some curds, too.
Yeah, yogurt.
Yeah, let's go.
A little yogurt, yeah. So, and then, 26. She reached out her hand for the tent peg and her right hand for the workman's hammer. Then she struck Sisera. She smashed his head, and she shattered and pierced his temple. I wish we had this to music. It'd be much better music.
Yeah, can you imagine singing this on Sunday? Yeah. You're like covering the kids' ears.
Right. Don't listen to this part. And then the best part is the last verse of this particular part. Between her feet, he bowed. He fell. He lay. Between her feet, he bowed, he fell. Where he bowed, there he fell, dead. It's the poetry is just amazing. It's called, some of it's called stair step poetry, but it's like the whole, you can just kind of, if this was a song, you kind of picture it just slowing down. You want to like savor the moment of the destruction of the enemy.
You know, part of, I love this is actually the, in verse 24, where it says, basically says, of when it comes to women living in tents, she's the best.
Yeah, this is true.
I mean,
yeah.
If you're talking about putting tents and women together, she's the best.
She's the best. Number one.
She can drive a tent peg. She can set a tent up.
Yeah, right. Yeah, you want your tent set up right, you get jail.
That's it.
She can wield a hammer. Okay, so Sisera's dead, obviously. Now, what's going to happen back at home? Well, now we're going to hear about Sisera's mother. She looked and lamented, the mother of Sisera, through the lattice. Why does his chariot delay in coming? Why do the hoofbeats of his chariots tarry? So, yeah, Sisera's mother waiting back at the house, at the palace, whatever it is, looking through the lattice.
Like, this just seems mean. I mean, like, this next part's like, out of the window, like, she peered. The mother of, like, his mother's, like, waiting for her son to come home. Ha-ha, he's not coming home. Like,
yeah,
this is very, ouch, man.
Yeah, this is a low blow. This is very in your face, too. I think it's, I don't even know what the word to be to describe it. But it's pretty cold. It's, as far as like poetry goes, when you attack somebody's mom,
yeah,
you know it's cold. Yeah, so she's wondering what's happened. Where, you know, why is he delayed? And her princesses, her wise princesses, would answer her. Indeed, she repeats her words to herself. So it's like everybody, they're reassuring her, and she's trying to reassure herself. And here's what they say. Here's the reason for the delay. Oh, are they not finding? Are they not dividing the spoil? That's probably why, right? And then it goes on. Literally in the Hebrew, your translations are going to say probably like maiden or young woman or something like that. In the Hebrew, it's a womb, two wombs for every warrior. So, yeah, you've got these soldiers going to be bringing back some women. Basically, the spoils of war, which is barbaric, but that's the way that these things would happen. To a womb, two wombs, a woman, two women for every warrior. To Sisera, a spoil of dyed work, a spoil of dyed work embroidered, dyed work of double embroidery on the neck of the spoiler. That's kind of where like that little conversation ends. That's why they're delayed. They're busy gathering up women and the spoils of war, and that's why they haven't come back. And it kind of ends it there as far as Sisera's mother goes. Of course, we know what happened, and she's going to find out soon enough. And then the song concludes like this. Thus, let all your enemies perish, O Lord, but let those who love him be like the rising of the sun in its might. And then one prose verse line that ends this chapter. And the land was undisturbed for 40 years.
Yeah, that's that had rest, that elusive rest.
That elusive rest. Yeah, so that is kind of uncomfortable for us in many ways, I know, because we're not used to singing things like that, and we're not used to talking like that. But that is the way that the Old Testament very frequently talks about the enemies. And I think it is helpful to repeat what we said earlier with regard to the enemies, that these, you have to think of these people in two different ways. Yes, they were actual people, but they were also, as the enemies of Israel, they were the enemies of God, and they were those who sought to destroy that which God was working in the world. All of this is part of the prehistory leading up to God's ultimate work of sending his Messiah. That's why he has Israel. That's why he chooses this people, so they can bear this promise. And any threat to them is also a threat to that promise. And so when they're destroyed, this is God's way of making sure that those promises are passed down and, of course, eventually fulfilled. There's more to it than that, but I think that's important to bear in mind when you when you either read or sing things like that. Have you ever sung the Song of Deborah? I was looking this morning to see if I could find if there was any record of it being used liturgically, like historically in the church in some way. And I couldn't find anything, but I'm sure it's sung in some way and in some traditions.
Yeah, I have never sang it. No.
Yeah. Yeah. But, all right. Well,
that is it, man. We are out of time.
That's it.
One more chapter down. So we're getting back in. We'll get back into some narrative history.
Yeah. We'll get to Mr. Gideon next time.
All right, guys, if you would like to support the podcast, you can do so by going over to 1579.org. Click on that donate page. You can become a contributor. Thank you so much to those of you who do that. Chad, I will see you next week.
See you then.